Hi, everyone. Welcome to Scientific Methods Panel First Meeting Subgroup 1. We're happy that you were able to join us today. Just some starting points for our day-to-day, and then we'll jump into a roll call and start discussing our measures. A discussion guide was sent out to the subgroup members Friday evening. This document will be our guide for today's meeting and for the measures discussion. We will follow the order presented on this document. Consensus not for the first seven measures means that we will be talking about them, and that information has been provided on your discussion guide. All other measures will not be discussed during today's call unless a member of the subgroup would like to take this opportunity to pull a measure. If you choose not to discuss additional measures, decisions from your planning analysis will be made final. And now, just pausing for a second to we'll come back to this. We'll do roll call, and then we'll ask if anyone would like to pull a measure for discussion, for your knowledge. In the same email that was sent out that had the discussion guide, there was a link to a SurveyMonkey. Just to make everything a little bit more efficient, we ask that you pull that SurveyMonkey up now and start casting your votes as we go through our reliability and or validity discussions at the conclusion of each measure discussion. You are free to start putting it in and not hit submit until the end. It just makes it easier for us if we get the results now instead of having to, you know, track you down later. And we will obviously prompt you every time it's time for you to cast your vote. Timing is limited on today's call. We have roughly 15 minutes to discuss each measure. We do have a lot of measures pulled for discussion already. And although we would like to come to consensus on these measures today, we do have a follow-up meeting scheduled for Friday, March 22nd from 1 to 3. That is a backup meeting. The goal, hopefully, we're able to get through the discussion of these measures today, but if not, we do have that time slated. And then I just wanted to remind everyone that this is a public call. The developer representatives are on the line to answer questions from staff or panel members. However, there will be no opportunity for public comment. For record keeping, we ask that you, every time you speak up, that you say your name so we know who's speaking and we can keep track of that. Before we do roll call, I just want to see if there's any questions about the structure of today's call.
Hi, this is Bijan. Mayo Clinic. I just tried to open up the link for SurveyMonkey, and it's not opening up for me.
What error are you getting? Is it just
It's just going blank. Going to the website apparently, but it's just I'm not getting to see anything in there. It's just blank white.
Okay. Send the link out again, and hopefully that will work for you. Any other questions or concerns?
No worries. You know what? I have two computers. The window-based one is working, so the Mac one is not. So that's fine, I guess.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, well, that will just go ahead and do roll call, May.
Okay. So, hello, everyone. This is May. I'm just going to do roll call for the assigned methods panel members who are assigned these subgroup measures. And, they, again, just to clarify, they are the ones who are who we need to cast final votes and use the SurveyMonkey for. So I heard Bijan, you're on the line, yes?
Yep, I am.
Okay, John Bott?
Yep, here.
Okay, Paul Karlansky?
I'm here.
Jeff Gepper?
Here.
And Sherry Kaplan?
Here.
All right, thank you. And then for all the other panel members, just to feel free to listen in.
And then we just wanted to remind everyone that these calls, we did change our structure, our conferencing system, so all lines are open, but we do ask that everyone mute their lines unless they are talking, just to reduce background. Okay, with that, I think we're ready to start. And I believe Michael will be going through our first measure.
Yeah, so we're going to start at the top of the discussion guide, measure number 3506. This is Michael Abrams talking here at NQF. The measure title, hospitalization after release with missed emergency department dizzy stroke. And I'm going to try to go through in 3 to 5 minutes. The discussion guide, just as it's laid out here, and I'll try to use headings and stuff so you can follow along with me. This is a new measure. Brief description, this measure is a measure of rates of patient admissions to the hospital for a stroke that occurs within 30 days of being treated and released from an emergency department, for symptoms that were presumed at that time during that emergency department visit to be benign dizziness or inner ear vestibular diagnosis. The numerator and denominator of this measure both are predicated upon primary diagnosis. Index visits for the denominator are the first one that appears in the window, the period window of performance. After that index visit, a person is not reentered into the analysis for 360 days following that. This is what would be referred to as an outcome measure. In other words, it looks at, in particular, a stroke event leading to a hospitalization as the outcome. It's a claims-based measure. And testing was done by the developer using four Johns Hopkins Hospital emergency department venues, 2,152 emergency department visits were evaluated as part of their evaluation or of their scientific testing. And then the CRISP, or the Chesapeake Regional Information System data set, which has data across the 47 regulated hospitals in Maryland, was used to supplement the data. The data that's looked at spans 2012 to 2017. There were no specific exclusions listed in the specifications for this measure, presumably because the specifications were specific enough to identify the cases and the venues. The level of analysis we're talking about here is facility hospitals, hospital EDs. A risk adjustment was, in fact, done and tested, and that was based on looking at 91 to 360 days post, so 3 months to 12 months post the emergency department visit, to find, if you will, baseline rates of stroke events happening, and then using that to adjust for the 30-day follow-up stroke, which is the focus of this measure. The reliability testing, we'll move right on to that, and there's that specific bullet, so I'm right on, approaching the bottom of this first page. For the reliability testing, you all, three of you rated it as moderate, two as low. That's why we're discussing it today. Consensus has not been reached. Let me remind you what that reliability looks like. The developers provided estimates of stability within a hospital over three successive time periods that were roughly 18 months each, and then gave 95% confidence intervals. In their discourse, they say that those confidence interval windows were generally stable with time, even as they did vary a little bit, particularly for one hospital, but they were stable enough over time to suggest the reproducibility or stability of the measure within hospitals. So that was the description of reliability. Now, perhaps it's a good opportunity to pause for a second and see if the committee members wanted to clarify anything about reliability in discussion, or think about their vote that they made, and if they want to revise that or they're okay with that.
Well, this is John Bott. Maybe not specifically reliability, but in the summary notes, you just noted that this was risk adjusted, but the measure Stewart in submitting this in response to question 2B3.1, they say no risk adjustment or stratification. So there's some discrepancy there.
Discrepancy. Okay.
Yeah, this is Bijan from Mayo Clinic. This is, that's my point too. I'm just kind of looking through that, and I think as John pointed out, I think I had the same issue.
This is Paul Kalansky. I think it's because they did a very tricky way of doing. Actually, I thought it was very smart the way they did risk adjustment. They said, what would be the expected baseline rate for stroke over the next 30 days in the specific population that showed up? And then they answered this question, showing the risk hazard function for stroke after ED visit in that population. So they therefore got the 90-day and the 90 to 360-day period calculated. But it was, they used the same population, so it actually risk-adjusted itself. So in a way, they didn't do an outside model risk adjustment, but they did account for risk within the...
Yes, that's correct. That's my reading of the application as well, that they, within individual, did a risk adjustment based on their the follow-up, this 3 months to 12-month period post the ED admission. And any other comments or concerns, or perhaps one of the key comments is that the developer should in the future clarify specifically that they applied this risk adjustment to the scientific testing. It's my reading that indeed they did, but there sounds like there's some confusion among other reviewers about that point.
This is David Newman-Joker. I just wanted to let you know that I'm on the phone. If you have questions you'd like me to answer, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you, David. So this is Karen from NQF. I think it'll really help us. I know we've already kind of jumped ship and we're talking about risk adjustment. Let's try to do this in order of reliability first and specs and go in order. That, I think that'll just be a little easier for us to make notes and us to make sure that everybody's voting in the way they need to vote. It sounds like we mostly got through risk adjustment. We'll come back and tag that one in a minute. But let's just go back to specifications. And even before that, do we need to do, I think we need to, this is apologies on my part, we actually need to do some disclosures of interest. So those of you who have been with us before remember that we do this on occasion. So I think we need, what we're trying to do is just ask our methods panel members to disclose anything that might, that, you know, things that you do in your other non-QF life that may have a bearing on any of this work, and that could be paid work or voluntary work, that sort of thing. Things that you disclose are not necessarily conflicts, but we just want to make sure everything is disclosed. So if you don't mind, let's go ahead and I'll just go through the list as May did it. So Bijan, do you have anything that you want to disclose?
Not specifically, but I do have some projects, I mean, something completely unrelated with John Hopkins OBGYN department.
Okay, but nothing that has to do with any of the measures under discussion today?
No.
Thank you. John?
Yeah, nothing to disclose in relation to these measures. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Paul?
Nothing to disclose.
Thank you. Jeff?
Just in general, that Patel holds the measures management contract with CMS, which manages a portfolio of measures for accountability programs. But other than that, nothing to disclose.
Thank you, Jeff. And Sherry?
I'm on the NQF All-Cause Readmissions Committee. I sit on our hospital's readmissions committee, and I'm on the Yale core team. MIPS inpatient measures, technical advisory panel, but none of them specific to the measures I think I have today, because I think I filled that out in advance of this whole review process.
Yep. Yeah, we ask you before each cycle or as we know which measures are coming through, and then we have you publicly state on our calls. So thank you so much. Okay. So, and sorry to interrupt the flow of your discussion. So, Michael, reliability, do you want to do that? Do you want to start with
yes.
the specifications and then go into the testing and what was or wasn't provided and then we'll kind of walk our way through?
We were talking about reliability. You want to start with specifications and discuss that? Initially, so are there any, so the way I would summarize, the points I think up in the top of the page summarize the specifications pretty well with regard to primary diagnoses being identified, both in the numerator and denominator. The only comments that came up from you all for discussion is, you'll find at the bottom of the page, of the second page under items to be discussed, is the emergency department venue well enough defined? was brought up by one individual. Given that these are all facilities in regulated hospitals, perhaps that isn't a point that needs much discussion, but there was some question about that. And another, with regard to the specification specifically, is our hospitalizations well enough defined as well with regard to facility type and the observation of a stay? Was there any concern about that? Again, given the venues and the data that was employed, that may not be a lengthy discussion, but were there any concerns about how the measure was specified specifically to isolate the counts of cases and then of cases that that achieved this this measure of seeing a missed stroke event? Anything from the committee about that?
Yeah, this is John Bodett. I think those are probably my observations. I mean, for the sake of Hopkins doing this with Hopkins facilities, yeah, that's fine. That's, they know what their emergency departments are. But, I mean, the idea of is this measure adequately specified so it would be implemented in a standardized way? You then need to specify what constitutes an emergency department visit, what constitutes a hospitalization. And unless I missed it, I looked pretty thoroughly in that specified section. They don't define what constitutes an emergency department visit nor a hospitalization. I mean, of course, in the, like, for example, in the field of readmissions, it's much discussed as is an observation stay a hospitalization, and the, you know, is it a minimum of X hours or X days to constitute a hospitalization? What types of facilities is called a hospitalization? Does it, you know, span long-term care facilities? Is it acute care facilities only, et cetera, et cetera? These need to be specified if the measure is going to be implemented in a standardized way.
Any other discussion about that from other committee members?
Not about that, but I have another issue.
Okay. Another issue is related to specifications in particular, just so we keep on focused on that for the moment.
This is Sherry. I found the specifications daunting. I thought they were pretty they're pretty complicated. And at a university teaching hospital, I get it. Rolled out into the field, I'm not so sure that these things can be implemented as well. But I found three things confusing. One, the sampling with replacement. If the patient's replaced in the sample post-discharge, you know, after 1 year but before 3 years, this, I got lost about with the, does the patient go back into the sampling pool after 1 year but before 3 years? Is the developer on the line? Can they clarify that?
Yeah, it's David. Sorry for the confusion. That's exactly correct. There's a one-year follow-up period after an initial visit during which no.
Can you speak up? I can't hear.
Yeah, you're very difficult to hear.
My apologies. Let me. Is this any better now?
Only slightly.
Let me try.
Hello?
Can you hear me better now?
Yes. Yep.
Much better.
So sorry about that. I apologize. I'm on a train, so there may be some ambient noise, but yes, the reviewer had the correct assessment, which is that we took the approach of saying you get one bite at the apple as a patient as an ED index visit, then for the rest of that year, you're only looking at the outcomes for that patient, but then you can be renewed and have another ED dismiss visit a year later as long as it's still within the assessment window, the performance period. And again, we're happy to, you know, if there are some specific suggestions for how we could enhance the measure, we're happy to consider those. We appreciate your help.
I just think that needs a lot more clarification, because if I were, you know, if I were monitoring and following these patients, presuming they are candidates for a readmission within that time window, it's pretty, the way it's written now, you know, it took me a while, and this is what I do. To kind of figure out who was actually in the sample and who was excluded. So that some more clarification, more detail, I think would be very helpful.
We're happy to do that. Thank you.
So any other comments about specifications specifically right now? If not, we'll move on and talk about reliability directly.
Yeah, this is John Budd again. Their response to S5 and the MIF form, there's a very obtuse sentence that states additional data sources may be required to fully understand admissions that occur out of network. The missing data can be approximated. There's yep. nothing that talks about the methodology for approximation that's acceptable. How is out of network defined, et cetera, and et cetera. This is just an ill-defined concept that, again, to administer the measure uniformly across a number of entities, you know, that would not cut it.
Yeah, agreed. And we'll talk about that at the when we get into validity. There's a 17% loss that's expressed in the application related to out of network, and clarification of that, it was one of the things that you all were concerned about. So we will talk about that in validity. Anything else specifically about specifications before we look at reliability a little bit more detail here? Okay.
Sherry, this is Karen. I thought you said you had three questions. Did I misunderstand you, or have we lost two of them?
Never mind.
Okay.
I got lost.
This is Paul. Before we move on out of reliability, I'm just a little concerned about the wide confidence intervals because
yes.
it's going to impair the ability to distinguish one place from another place. And if you looked at the values from one place to the next, they varied. But if you looked at the confidence intervals, they did not distinguish one from the other.
Yes, agreed. For the most part, that was the case. So that was a key concern about the way the signal to noise was presented, and the suggestion that this indicated stability, even as there were wide confidence intervals, and some change even within hospital with time. So any additional comments about that or thoughts about revising your ratings on reliability at this point, or are we comfortable with where you're at with three moderate ratings and two low ratings?
So this is Karen, just to go back a little bit, and this is before Michael's time, so he might not have realized this, but we've talked in the past about what score level reliability methodologies we might be happy to take. Obviously, signal to noise is one. The split half reliability methodology is a second one. And there's been a little bit of non-clarity as to whether showing confidence intervals in the way that this was done would actually reflect reliability. NQF in the past has accepted those if the confidence bands don't overlap. But I think the methods panel has been a little bit more reluctant to accept those. So that's the background a little bit. Along with that background, though, is also a reminder that if appropriate data element validity has been conducted and the values, the results are adequate, then we don't actually at this point require additional reliability. So kind of two things for you to think about. Number one, will you accept what was given as reliability? And if you don't, then we need to think about the data element validation that was done and whether or not that is acceptable, because that can be used in lieu of what you don't like about the stability analysis that the developers did.
In terms of, this is Bijan from Mayo. So in terms of data element validity, reliability, I mean, the very fact that this measure is going to use claims data, I'm just confused as to what exactly are we talking about data element validity or reliability here? Because these are all sort of, you know, at least as far as I understand, I mean, they are all sort of already reliable, right? The measures that would be potentially be used in this measure.
Right.
Yeah, it's not the data element reliability that we'd be interested in necessarily. It would be the data element validity, so the claims data. So can we feel assured that what is listed in the claims data are accurate. That's the data element validity question.
To me, they are.
Yeah, this is Paul. I was actually I thought they did a pretty good job. They relied on the literature for validity of using claims data to document the diagnosis of stroke, and then they performed some auditing and chart review to confirm the validity of the claims-based approach to validate the ED diagnosis of dizziness. So I thought that from that point of view, they did a good job.
So, Karen, can you clarify whether we're on score level or what data element do you call it, reliability? Because I'm confused.
Yeah, it's tricky. So, and sorry, Michael, I'm stepping in here.
Okay.
For score level, they did their point estimates with confidence intervals across 3 years, I think.
That's right. That's right. So
that's what they have described as score level reliability. So one of the questions is, would you accept that? And then kind of the corollary is, if you don't accept that, then I'm reminding you that if you do accept their data element validation, then that could suffice. Does that make sense?
Okay. I'm back to concerned about the amount of variability. And given they only have four hospitals, there's not a whole lot that you can do with that limited sample size at the facility level, but there is a fair amount of variability over time within hospital. And so my concern is that, for example, Hospital B has a visit rate of 27 that goes all the way down to 2 over
right. The
2 time intervals, and then other hospitals go from negative to positive for an interval of about 10. And, you know, that's a fair amount. There's not a lot you can do with this, but it's disturbing enough to be concerned about the within-hospital variation, and that's why I didn't give it a very high. I gave it a low rating on that score. It would be helpful to know, you know, obviously there's only so much you can do with the sort of, this almost looks like pilot data with the data you have. On the other hand, boy, that's a lot of variation, and it's a little disturbing.
Yeah. Other comments about that reliability testing and whether or not it indicates stability? So the last person who spoke expressed some concern about that.
Yeah, I think this is Bijan, and I had the same comment, and I think for Hospital B, they did mention that there was some transition during the measure period, but even if you ignore Hospital B, then Hospital C, it kind of, you know, goes from 19 to 37, almost it doubles. So
yeah.
Although the developer is sort of saying that, you know, there is not enough, the numbers are not heterogeneous, but I think when the numbers become, like, you know, double, I mean, you kind of start to wonder whether it is really stable enough.
Yes, got it.
I also was very concerned because even the center, which upgraded its stroke care, and it went from 27.5 down to 2.3, the 2.3 still fell within the confidence intervals from the previous period. So, yeah, how are you going to distinguish performance?
Yeah.
Ostensibly dramatic change, which still falls within the confidence intervals of the previous metric. You know, it's previous testing. Sorry. So that variability can concern me.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Jeff. Can you just clarify again the rating process? So let's say that we have consensus that the measure score reliability testing, either the methods weren't appropriate or the results were not compelling. So you're saying if that's the finding, then that's okay because we can rely upon the validity testing of the patient-level data, which I agree was very well done. So do we not score reliability at all in that circumstance?
No, in that circumstance, you would just use what you would score for validity in place of. So it's kind of two different questions. If you think the methodology itself wasn't appropriate, then just disregard. But if you're okay with the methodology and the results are really causing you some pain, then you may not want to use those validity results instead.
Well, I think it's hard to tell on reliability, right, with four hospitals and a bunch of variations. I mean, I guess you could say you don't think this is reliable at all, you know, but that's another issue I have. The score, you know, it's like a two-dimensional analysis that's somehow summarized in a one-dimensional number. Like you got, you know, one dimension is the method, and then another dimension is the result. And somehow we have to, like, collapse that into to one number. But it's I'm still – so I think what I would like to do is be able to score this low on reliability, which is what I did. And then, you know, it's moderate on validity because the data element validity is pretty good. Now, what you do with that, you know, you can decide. You can decide to ignore my reliability scoring because you're just going to take the data element validity results, and that's going to be good enough.
So what will happen is we will ask all of you to re-vote on both reliability and validity, and we will take the majority vote, and the majority vote whether it's pass or fail. If the majority of you believe that the measure does not pass reliability, then we will not, at this point, forward it on to the standing committee. We will send it back to the developer, describe, you know, the concerns that you had, and hopefully the developer in that case would maybe do some additional analysis and bring it back next cycle. If you guys do pass it as a group, then we will forward it on to the standing committee along with all your discussions, and they can do with it as they want. They may just take it as is and maybe add some additional commentary. They may disagree with your votes and add some additional commentary. Who knows what they would do?
So what you're saying is because I view the data element validity as moderate, I should change my reliability score to moderate.
I am not necessarily saying that. I'm saying that if you think the methodology for reliability is appropriate, then you need to consider the results and decide whether those tell you something different than what you would land on if you looked at validity. If you think the methodology for reliability is not correct, then it's kind of irrelevant what the results are, right? So you would just kind of disregard it and pretend they hadn't put anything down, in which case our criteria say that it's okay not to do anything else. You can just rely on the validity piece.
This is David Newman-Soker. May I just offer a quick aside just to give people some context?
We'll let you this time, David, just to maybe help us get out of the hole.
So this was obviously a difficult thing because people haven't submitted this kind of measure before, and so we were trying to work with NQF staff to figure out what to do. We realized that the sample of hospitals that we have and the variation that we have, both in terms of the type of hospitals and the number of hospitals and everything else, is not ideal. We get that. But we were encouraged to submit something for score level reliability, and so we did. We knew that technically we didn't have to sort of meet the minimum standard. We agree with you. We concur completely that the validity approach is the place where this is strong in terms of the data element validity. And I hope that you'll consider the sort of the context. We actually had one other set of data from the Kaiser Mid-Atlantic data, but technically it was a health plan and not an individual hospital. So we saw we have more data than we have, but we couldn't really submit them because the plan data then was only one plan and we didn't have multiple examples of the plan. So I think what we were trying to do was follow the recommendations in terms of what our submission looked like. Your assessments are very much in line with our opinion of the measure as well.
Karen, this is Sherry. I'm now mightily confused because it looks like to me that the reviewers, the developers did the correct analysis. They did it in the right way, but they're being penalized because there's not there's a fair amount of within hospital variation. If this is being used to assess variation between hospitals, that's a problem. Now, and then leaning on, oh, yeah, but the data source is good, is to me a real logical inconsistency. It's like, okay, yeah, but we got it from the right data source. Okay, but if you can't tell if it's being used to compare hospitals, that's a big focus. That's where you should see more between than within hospital variation to do it reliably. So I'm a little bit... I'm jarred by you penalize. We're talking about penalizing the developer for doing the right thing, but finding some really concerning findings, at least initial ones, because it doesn't to me look like we've got enough data here yet to make some more long or more sweeping generalizations about how reliable this measure would be in the field. But I'm confused about what the action to take is, because they do report the scores. They are concerning. They did it the right way, but now we're going to ignore that and say, oh, yeah, but the data source is good. That feels to me like a jarring inconsistency.
So don't ignore it if you think they did it the right way.
So this is Michael speaking. So here's one thought I have about the way they proffered their reliability. There's a time component in there that is leading to variation. I actually think they would have been better off just doing a straight split half, and they would have come up with a better indication of stable results. So perhaps that was the fatal flaw to the way that they proffered that reliability. But there certainly is variation, at least in that, I think it was Hospital B, showing that with time there were changes apparent, so they couldn't, then say, things stayed stable in the same hospital over time. So,
well, that's not exactly. There's variation across time within hospital, but there's also variation within hospital within a time period, and that's what you're looking at if that's how it's going to be used. If it's
right.
going to be used at a point in time to compare hospitals, the confidence bands there are too wide to be
okay.
confident that you could use it for that purpose. So this is back to how are you going to really use this in practice. So across time, there's a lot of variation, and within hospital, there's a lot of variation. So both
okay.
of those things are of concern.
Do we want to look at validity
maybe
quickly and then vote and then re-vote?
Well, we're going to be doing voting offline with the survey
okay.
tool, so we don't have to take any time. If you have that open and you feel like you're ready to vote on reliability, you can go ahead and do that now so you don't forget. Otherwise, scribble your idea so you don't forget later on when you do go back. So, yeah, let's go ahead to vote.
Yeah, so let's move on to validity. So it's the bottom of the first page, ratings for validity. Let me just quickly review for you how that was done. It was data element testing with both ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes implicated, which is good. And they used previous work to look at sensitivity and specificity regarding the numerator, which is stroke events in particular. The results there are listed for you on the beginning of the next page. They also looked more recently using meta-analytic reviews to validate various aspects of the testing as well. And again, reporting sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive values that were relatively high, although notably low for one particular set of codes referring to acute stroke. And then they did specific chart reviews. Now I'm getting into the middle of the next page there with regard to or electronic health record reviews with regard to identifying dizzy cases, again, both ICD-9 and ICD-10. The numbers are presented there. Perhaps this might assuage the concern about venue. Perhaps it doesn't, but they did do, at least within their Johns Hopkins facilities, demonstrate very high correspondence with regard to discharge status and identifying particular cases of relevance to this measure. And then talking about the validity of the measure to discriminate between hospitals. They also demonstrate that, looking at across the four facilities, the rates were, and this is the second to the last bullet before the items to be discussed. You can see across the four facilities, the rates of dizzy visits varied from 2.7 to 21.5 per 10,000 dizzy visits. So that's their suggestion that there is indeed variation across hospitals in this case as opposed to demonstrating stability. And then finally, the last bullet there before the items to be discussed point is that they talked about this out-of-network issue. And that there are something like 17.3%. It's a little bit unclear what they mean. Presumably they mean 17.3% of their total cases are lost, or part of the data is lost, related to the fact that it's an out-of-network hospital where they can't see the data, even with CRISP, using the CRISP system as well, because of the way it's coded in the CRISP system with regard to primary diagnoses versus secondary diagnoses. So that potentially is a threat to validity in the sense that, you know, you're missing a bunch of cases where you want to see the follow-up, and the follow-up might change your results. So I'll pause there. And, you know, a key point about the validity perhaps is that missing data piece, but open it for a discourse among you all regarding your concerns or questions about validity.
This is Paul. The data element validity seems strong. The measure validity was a little less clear.
This is Sherry. I agree with Paul. I think the issue of variation within hospitals, again, because when you're comparing mean rates or the average rate for 10,000 visits, the confidence intervals are very wide in these comparisons. And when you're trying to compare one rate to another, that's a problem, and it's going to be a problem, it looks like, for this measure throughout, because you can't get significant differences between hospitals with confidence intervals that wide.
Sorry, this is David again. We did see a statistically significant difference between our hospital that orders MRIs all the time and our community hospital that doesn't have access to any stroke services. I realize it's not as good as having, you know, 500 hospitals and really seeing the variation. These are all, you know, Johns Hopkins hospitals, and there is going to be less variation necessarily, but hopefully that at least helps.
Yeah, but the effect size is so huge that, you know, it strains the imagination you could get an effect that big. I mean, it agreed that when you go out and take this beyond four hospitals, you probably are going to get some outliers that really you could identify as sub-performers, but the confidence intervals were still disturbing. When you adjust, well, maybe this isn't the right place to ask. I was going to ask about adjustment. Did you do anything trying to narrow that confidence interval?
You can go ahead and answer that one, David, since we're in validity.
So, yeah, this issue of adjustment, I know you guys had a question before about whether there was adjustment or not. We didn't know how to describe the observed minus expected methodology. Originally, I said it was adjusted, and then we had a back-and-forth discussion with the folks at NQF that we were working with, and people generally felt that it wasn't adjustment in the sense that NQF thought of it that way. So there was a little bit of terminological confusion there. But we do believe that we account for the base rate differences in the populations because we're looking at patients as their own controls, or the population of patients as its own control. The issue of whether we made specific attempts to try to narrow the confidence intervals, most of the things that we tried to do in terms of, you know, parsing out the reliability and everything else, naturally, sort of when we sort of broke it into smaller pieces, the confidence intervals weren't any better. We didn't do any specific methodological things trying to narrow the confidence interval in an adjustment process. Was there a particular method that you had in mind?
Not specifically, but, you know, did you do any hierarchical modeling? I know the sample size is tiny, but just to see if you could kind of get the hospital level effect differentiated from the patient level?
So we did not, again, sort of sample size constraints, but I think that what we have here, you guys don't know the sort of behind the scenes of what we've been doing for the past few years contextually, but we're trying to take a more complicated approach where we plot out the rate of return curves for these patients, and we have much more information conceptually over time and condense it down into a measure that other people can, you know, use by counting, relatively speaking, rather than doing something more analytically intensive, even though I realize that the sampling issue makes this imperfect in terms of its difficulty level. It's much easier than the stuff that we're trying to do, that we're doing for our own purposes internally. We were trying to make it simple. I realized that in the process of doing that, it's imperfect in terms of the noise issues. But the other problem here is that if we can't get this out into the public consciousness, we can't get more data. It's sort of, it's a catch-22 problem for this sort of new metric issue.
So, Michael speaking again here. So, any other discourse on validity? And anybody want to make a comment about that, the missing data, the out-of-network missing data issue? Okay, should we move on to the next?
Is there anything else?
I don't think so. No.
Does anybody else have any other comments? And let's be clear, when we say missing data, the idea there is, and David, I'm asking you because I want to make sure I understand this measure. The idea is that a patient can go to any hospital when they have a stroke, not necessarily just the one that they had that dizzy diagnosis earlier. So that missing data business is saying, hey, they went to a different hospital when they actually had their stroke. So it might be hard to know if there was a stroke after that dizzy diagnosis. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are two. Yeah, absolutely. There are two layers, though. The first layer is not knowing whether the patient, you know, who was seen at Hopkins Emergency Department and discharged got admitted with a stroke to the University of Maryland. We address that broadly by dealing with the CRISP regionalized data and the Kaiser plan, which you don't see the data because we encourage not to submit it, was, you know, they have their own follow-up for all their patients, so they have sort of all the data. The second piece of that is that the reason why the CRISP data are incomplete is that they only rely on Maryland's Hospital Rate Setting Commission, which only gathers data on hospital facility-coded diagnoses, which turn out to be more different than anyone would like than the professional fee-coded diagnoses, and it's essentially their complementary data set. So when you use the professional fee-coded diagnoses and the facility fee-coded diagnoses, you get a higher event rate than using either of them alone, and the CRISP data don't have those out-of-network professional fee codes. They only have the out-of-network hospital facility codes, and that's the 17% that are missing the professional fee codes from the CRISP data.
So just to be clear, David, if you would, is 17.3%, that's of your total sample that you're losing or of the out-of-network sample? Can you clarify that for us?
Just need to... I'm trying to find the spot. I know we have Matt on the phone. Matt, do you have that in front of you? I'm not finding it in the...
Yeah, I need to look it up real quick, too.
Okay. So that remains as a question. You know, is it one in five of all the observations that you're looking at, or is it one in five of a subset of the out-of-network? That would make a difference, obviously, and some idea about the impact on the measure as well, to the extent that you can provide that. One other point, perhaps before we close out the discussion, one of my colleagues reminded me of, any further interest among the committee right now to talk about the risk adjustment approach that they used here, which, you know, again, was looking at the 3 to 12 month window post ED discharge to look for baseline events? Anybody else want to discuss that, whether that was appropriate or of concern moving forward here? So we can move on to the next measure and the inspiration here.
Okay, I think we've discussed as much as we can. David, if or Matt, if somewhere in the next hour or so you find that number and can answer that, just kind of.
I have it here.
Okay.
It's the estimated missing stroke events divided by the total stroke events. So it is 17% of all numerator events.
So this is Sherry. I don't want to bog us down, but if you get a sense of is it missing at random or is it missing not at random, it's probably related to the out of network issue. But your assertion that it reduces precision to do some kind of multiple imputation, it actually does not. It does reverse. It inflates the mean and narrows the variance. That's why I was asking you about sort of sensitivity to treatment of these kinds of, you know, adjustments. This is not a risk adjustment, but if you did did you think about doing multiple imputation and looking at the sensitivity of your results to that, the sensitivity and specificity of your results to that kind of imputation?
We did not do that, though. I'm sure that we could. We could. I think the. It's a good point. We should assess whether the missingness is likely to have an impact. I think the conceptually, from our perspective, the relationship between the out of network follow up missingness, which I think is critically important, was more significant than the relationship between the hospital versus professional fee billing. So conceptually, just from a structural standpoint, it seemed to me like it was a reasonable assumption to make to say that the professional fee and hospital fee billing relationship would likely be similar overall across hospitals rather than different. There's no way for us to verify that with 100% certainty with the data that we have, but conceptually it seems much more likely that there's a bias in who returns to another hospital, but not necessarily a bias in whether a coder codes the facility code as stroke or not, as opposed to a physician code to the stroke or not.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't answer that question well. Somebody said they were still confused.
Yeah, that's okay. We will clarify it in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, David. So hearing no other, I'll give you just a second. Any other things you want to ask about this measure? Okay. If you have your SurveyMonkey open, you may want to go ahead and vote on validity as well. You'll be voting on both reliability and validity for this measure. All right. Let's go to the next measure. So that one took us. Yeah.
Excuse me. I just have a question on the SurveyMonkey issue. Is
sure.
there a concept that as of the discussion we will have reached consensus and therefore we're going to all vote the same, or are you just going to tally the votes? And then, in other words, what happens if we don't have consensus on the SurveyMonkey after all of this discussion?
Right. If you don't have consensus even after all of this discussion, we will go ahead and forward the measure to the standing committee and let them grapple with it, with all of the description of what you're struggling with as well. So that will go to them.
They will know what it was that was of concern in this committee.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. They'll actually know it in two ways. Number one, we will write a fairly detailed summary that will go in what we call their preliminary analysis that we prepare for them. But we also provide your initial analysis, that PA that you guys did. We make that available, too, so they could actually go back and look at, you know, your actual words, not just our summary, if they want to.
This is John Budd. I don't know if others ran across this, but I voted on this measure, and I couldn't get back to, you know, it seemed like I had to leave SurveyMonkey in order to get back in to vote on the second measure. Is there?
That's exactly what just happened to me.
Me too.
Yep, that was done by design, so you'll have to submit a separate survey for every measure you vote on today.
All right.
Did you guys hear, you did hear Miranda? Yeah. So that's how it'll work. You have to vote and then get out and come back. Okay. Let's move away from dizziness and stroke and go to gout. So,
thank you very much for the opportunity to be in and listen and to comment. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Helpful.
Bye-bye.
Could you please say what measure number we're moving on to? There's a disagreement between the agenda and the discussion guide and to the sequence of these measures.
Yeah, we are doing 2549E. Gout serum urate target. Have you found that in the guide? Everybody good?
Yeah, thanks. I'll look for it now.
Okay. So this is a new measure, but it's not a completely new measure to NQF. It is a ECQM or an e-measure that has been previously approved for trial use. You guys might not be as familiar with that kind of pathway to considering measures, so I've added a little bit of detail about what that means here. That does not mean that this measure has been previously endorsed. It has not. It has been approved for trial use, and that means that some of our other criteria, a standing committee has looked at the measure and felt like it met the other criteria, but by definition, testing data, reliability, and validity was not considered previously at all. So this is the first time that people will be looking at reliability and validity for this measure. So it is the percentage of patients 18 and older with a diagnosis of gout treated with a ULT for at least 12 months. And then the numerator is whose most recent serum urate result is less than 6.8 mg per DL. It is an intermediate clinical outcome. The data sources are EHRs and registry. So again, remember this is an e-measure or an ECQM. And in terms of it is not risk-adjusted, level of analysis is noted as both group or practice and individual clinicians, so both has been selected. In terms of reliability, the ratings of the subgroup were 4 high and 1 moderate, which means that it does pass with a high rating. We're saying high because that's the majority rating. And they did a signal to noise analysis from the RISE registry data. The results are there in front of you. We did note that because this measure has been specified for both the individual clinician as well as the group practice, we should have seen 2 sets of reliability results, one for individual, one for group. So we did not see that. We are going to ask the standing committee about that and what they feel is appropriate there. The developers also described some testing, and they actually put it in their submission form as reliability testing. However, what they did, we actually consider to be validity testing of the data elements. So I'm going to go through that, even though we're not going to discuss reliability necessarily, just because I think some of what they did hinges on their validity testing. So they did 2 different things. They looked at 3 sites and actually used the ECQM specifications to get an automated report, and they checked back from what's on that report, checked back to the actual medical record in the EHRs, and computed some Kappa agreement scores. And they did it for the numerator, the denominator, and their exclusions. And the results, the Kappa results, range from, looks like the lowest of the 3 of those is 0.78. All the way up to 1. They also did, they talked a little bit about some auditing of the RISE registry. So RISE registry actually takes data from many different EHRs and pulls those data in. And they did an overall count of correct and incorrect values. They looked at 644 patients across 13 providers. So this doesn't exactly conform to our requirements for data element validation. So they did part of it. They really needed to not just give you one overall number. They needed to split it out between, at minimum, numerator, denominator, and exclusions. And we also asked for something more than just percent agreement, so some kind of kappa or preferably sensitivity, specificity, et cetera. That doesn't mean you can't at least see what they found when they looked at that data. It just wouldn't stand on its own for our testing. Now, when it comes to validity, we actually had consensus not reached amongst the subgroup. So two voted moderate, three low. They did the data element validation, which I have just described. They also did some score level validation, and they talked about a face validity assessment. And I think that face validity assessment is one place where people really got a little confused. So in terms of their construct validation, they correlated their measure result with another measure that can be computed out of the RISE registry. It's a monitoring measure. They didn't really talk about why they chose that as a comparator or the results they expected to see, but they did have a high correlation. Once again, they should have split that out between individual versus group. So that's the caveat there. We have pretty, even though face validity is, we consider it kind of the lowest form of validation, first of all, but we do have some kind of requirements for it. They, I think, talked a lot about what they did and who looked at it, but they had, they did some face validity from two different Gallup measures. And it doesn't seem to be the one that is actually under consideration. Not quite sure who the experts were, what the scoring range was. And there was, in that whole assessment, it was really a little bit more about, or at least part of it was about the development of the measure, and a lot of disagreement, it sounded like, as to the threshold use of the measure, the 6.8 versus the 6. Now, with all that in face validity, NQF would like to remind you that face validity is kind of the lowest form of validation. So what we don't want you necessarily to ignore it completely, but really pay attention to the empirical testing that was done. So the correlation analysis that you have, as well as the data element testing that you have. And don't get too in the weeds on that face validity, because not quite sure how much that matters in the face of actual empirical results. This measure is not risk adjusted. They did provide a conceptual rationale as to why they didn't risk adjust. So I think I've gone through most of what I wanted to remind you of. So we're less concerned with face validity if empirical testing was conducted. One thing that did come up that was a note from one of the subgroup members was about the comparator that was used in the construct validation. And right now, in terms of our requirements, we are silent on what measures are appropriate for use in score level validation analysis. So we do not necessarily require that they're using an outcome measure, for example. So we're silent on that, and basically the idea is there enough rationale, or do you feel like what they did use is a reasonable measure to use for their validation? So in terms of the action items that we want to have you discuss, we are not going to discuss reliability unless any of you feel like we need to, because, again, everybody pretty much landed on the side of reliability looked okay. Any desire to discuss reliability?
There was one issue regarding the specification, which was a little bit, they just need to clean it up. It says at several points, include the algorithm for how the data is collected, there's an exclusion for solid organ transplant. However, in certain of the text, there's also an exclusion for stage 3 to 5 renal failure, but it's not specified throughout the application. So it's unclear whether that is part of it, the exclusion or not. They just need to, you know, clarify it.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. So it was kind of one way in one part and another way somewhere else in the submission, so unclear.
Correct.
Thank you.
Karen, this is Sherry. I voted moderate for validity, but I have a question because I didn't know what to do with it. You can't get a result from the gout serum urate monitoring without monitoring. So those two measures are technically not independent. They're pretty much the same thing. So how do you guys deal with that? For example, you perform a hemoglobin A1C and then you get a value. Well, you can't get the value unless you perform the hemoglobin A1C. So how do you guys deal with the issue of validation when the measures aren't independent?
That's a good question. We don't require necessarily that they be independent, but I think part of you're not going to like me today, Sherry. Part of your decision today is whether you think the dependence is so bad that it's just not even worth kind of thinking about the analysis. You know what I'm saying?
So that's what I'm asking, because you can't get a value unless you perform the test. So, you know, those things are pretty much the same, almost the same.
Yeah.
And if you're using one as evidence of the accuracy of this measure for comparing the folks being compared, those measures are not independent, and I'm not sure what to do with it.
So in that case, you may want to just completely disregard that score level validity. Again, this is just a plain old intermediate clinical outcome measure, so we don't require that they do score level validity. So you might say, hey, they did it, but, you know, it's really, really weak, and I'm just going to ignore that.
But then you're back to face validity, which you said was not optimal in this case.
Now, actually, what you're back to is what they described under reliability. So what they talked about under reliability testing, they actually put in the wrong spot. They should have put that under validity. So they looked at the 3 EHR sites, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I will remind you, this is an e-measure, and it's one of the few places that we actually have requirements in terms of how much testing has to be done. And our requirements are e-measures have to be tested in more than one site. So they've actually tested in 3 sites, so they have hit that one. So if you go up to the we didn't number these pages. We need to number these pages, so we have page numbers on these discussion guides. You can look at the Kappa scores that they computed when they compared the EHR automated report to the full EHR. So you can look at that rather than, or in addition to, if you'd like, face validity.
So you're considering that as criterion, the physician chart abstraction as criterion validity?
Yes,
so
for the data elements.
The abstraction is the criterion to which the EMR abstraction is being compared. In that case, I couldn't find how many physicians abstracted the charts and how much agreement, if more than one, was between the physicians.
The physicians who abstracted the chart? I'm sorry, I'm not following your question, Sherry.
How many physicians abstracted charts? 1, 2, 6? And if more than one, first of all, if it was one, how accurate is that individual? And then secondly, if more than one, what was the agreement between physicians abstracting the charts?
Do we have either of the developers from this measure? This might be a good time to directly ask the developer if anybody is on the line.
Hi, yeah, you have Tracy Johansson and Lisa Suter from DACR on the line.
Hi, Tracy. Can you give us a flavor? Do you understand Sherry's question, and can you answer it?
I just want to make sure I do understand correctly. You're essentially saying for the abstraction that we did at the three testing sites for the measure, you wanted to know how many physicians were involved in that?
If you're comparing the EMR abstraction to the physician chart abstraction, I just want to know how many physicians abstract were involved in that chart abstraction. One, two, five?
Let me look through our documents. I know that was three sites, but I don't believe it was I believe it was more patient focused than specific provider focused. I'm gonna have to double check that real quick though.
So we'll circle back to that one.
This is Lisa. I think Tracy is looking for the number of providers that were included in the extraction of data. But Cher, you're asking whether or not there was more than one individual doing the medical record abstraction. There was only one physician per site, to my understanding, that was actually checking, pulling the medical records and reviewing the data per site. And Tracy can verify that.
Okay,
I think.
The physician and the site are confounded then. Ooh. All right, so each physician is independent, but you didn't give them a core set of things to abstract and see how much agreement there was between physicians about specific kinds of issues that could come up in the chart abstraction process itself. You didn't do that, right?
So I'm not sure I understand your question, but my understanding is for uniformity, there was a single abstractor at each site.
Yeah. My concern is when you don't know how accurate somebody is, if you're using them as the criterion, that sort of needs to get established. You know, how good are they? And we assume that all physicians are good, are perfect at what they do, but they're probably not. And there would be some disagreement between physicians if you get them a common set of things to abstract from a chart across the three sites. And what you'd want to do to interpret that as criterion validity is know how much agreement there would be across the three site physicians so that you could tell, you know, what you're looking at in terms of the variability, if any, about what they're drawing out of the chart. Are they agreeing in general so that you can use the physician report as the quotes criterion?
I think it's helpful to have that feedback. I also think in terms of this is verifying that a lab result is a lab result. So I think we had some assumption that the physicians would be capable of doing that consistently. But it's helpful to have your input on doing more formal criterion validity setup.
And this is Karen from NQF. Just to be clear, you didn't give these physicians any specific training or anything along those lines. You just asked them to compare?
We asked them to verify that each patient that was identified as having a serum urate level within the measurement time frame below 6.8 milligrams per deciliter actually had that value documented in the medical record.
Okay.
So this is Tracy. I do want to just point out here too that in that they were given, you know, a data collection form with very explicit questions for these elements in saying yes or no and making sure that matched with the EHR, with what was extracted from their records as well.
Right. The reason that I asked is we did a study and actually found that the physicians don't agree with EMR. The physicians actually, there is a fair amount of mismatch in prostate cancer. So I was just curious to know if you guys had actually gone through the process of agreement between physicians.
Thank you, Sherry. So we talked about the data element testing. Did anybody have any other questions or concerns about the three sites EHR testing? Okay, there's score level testing results. The question is just whether, you know, you feel like that those are compelling or not. Sounds like Sherry thinks not, since they are very much dependent on each other. And then the face validity assessment, again, we don't even allow that by itself for EHRs. You know, the quibbling that happened, I think, in the face validity assessment about the 6.8 versus the 6 is more clinical, so we would want the standing committee to deal with that anyway, if there's anything to kind of fuss about on that one. But would anybody like to talk about the face validity assessment? Okay, there was a little bit of concern about not having exclusions, testing of exclusions done. So our question for you is, did you see enough information provided around exclusions to decide whether or not there is sufficient frequency to warrant inclusion in the specifications of the measure? Perhaps the other way to ask it might be, is anybody concerned with the exclusions and what you were told about those? Perhaps the other way to ask.
Can you tell us what question on our PA form is in regard to exclusions?
Let's see. I might can in a minute. On the testing attachment, it is item 2B.2.
But on our form. I'm struggling to find out what I said about exclusions because I can't find the question on our form that we completed right now.
Yeah, give me just a second. Still looking for it. I haven't quite found it. The word exclusion shows up quite a bit. It's question 12. Please describe any concerns you have with measure exclusion.
Thanks. I just noted I had no concerns. So.
Okay. I think sometimes people aren't quite sure what we're asking for in there. Often what developers provide to us is a frequency of exclusion without, you know, major testing. And I think sometimes people are looking for maybe sensitivity analysis or something along those lines. We don't often get that. And let's see. I can tell you, let's see. Jeff, I think you might have been the one who was mostly concerned about exclusions. And then Paul, going back to your specifications question.
I think my only concern was there wasn't testing.
Okay. So since we're not really, we don't give any instructions on what we might mean by testing. They did tell us what the frequency of exclusions or the number of patients who were excluded were from the three sites. Is there anything you'd like to have seen?
Does that matter? I mean, the reason, just the number of exclusions doesn't answer the question of whether the exclusions are somehow distorting. But like you said, there's not really any guidance about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of the registries kind of make a statement along the lines of saying, with regard to missing data, there's not any missing data because we don't accept it. And I always find that a little, a little strange. I mean, just doesn't mean there's missing data. It's just that you just delete it.
Okay. How about any concerns about the lack of risk adjustment? They mostly relied on a conceptual rationale for not risk adjusting. They gave a little bit of information about geography. Is the conceptual rationale sufficient, or did anybody want to kind of talk about lack of risk adjustment?
This is John Bott. A common comment I made across the 10 measures, I probably made it in 6 or 7 of the 10, just while they presented a rationale, I disagree with their rationale. And I didn't have copious notes typed in for a variety of reasons. But I think my comment here was it seemed like, and this is going off of memory, which is dangerous, that it appears there's geographic variation. And unless we control for that apparent bias, providers in a certain geographic area are going to tend to look worse simply because we're punishing them for being in that geography. So it seems like they need to figure out how to control for that bias so as not to punish a facility who happens to be in a certain part of America.
Tracy or Lisa, do either of you have anything you'd like to tell John along those lines in terms of geography and why you didn't feel that you needed to risk adjust?
This is Lisa, and I'm going to ask Tracy to jump in because I am not as familiar with the geographic testing. Don't actually see geographic testing in the testing form that suggests that there are geographic differences in performance. What I see is geographic distribution of practices. So those percentages in Table 7 are not performance. Oh, I see bottom of 25%, top 25%. So there are some geographic differences. Personally, I don't think geographic differences argue for risk adjustment. I think the argument that I have heard in contrast to our conceptual model for risk adjustment is that some practitioners care for a disproportionate group of patients that might be challenging to have their serum urate levels appropriately managed. It's our experience that the combination of the particular serum urate target that we identified as part of the outcome definition for this measure, along with the abundance of medications, including newer medications in this area, suggests that there is much less of an argument for risk adjustment in this measure than there have been previously. So there are more medications and available to more types of patients than previously. And we have chosen to identify a serum urate target, which is much less likely to be as challenging to hit than a more stringent target based on your underlying comorbidities or other medical conditions or even social risk factors in terms of access to medications and things like that. So it was at the panel work group for the measures determination that with this combination of factors, it was better to move forward with a measure that we think is critical for improving gout control than to create a risk-adjusted measure that might be more challenging to implement and may not provide as rapid information as this measure would in terms of under-treatment of symptomatic hyperuricemia in the United States.
Okay. Thank you for that. I think the only other thing that came up is the subgroup did notice practice level variation. And the question is, do you feel that there's true differences between providers? And just a note that we're really talking about quantitative differences, not necessarily clinically meaningful differences, but that can be discussed by the standing committee.
Karen, can I ask a question? This is apropos of the last issue, sort of, but I'm sort of a recommendation maybe, but a thought that if you did the proportion of facilities or the proportion of groups that or individuals that did the serum urate monitoring and had an in-target value versus those who did the serum urate monitoring and did not, or at least the proportion that had either were not in target. It gets you out of this, you know, the independence issue I was worried about. And it looks like it's kind of resonating with the intent of the measure, the way it was just articulated by the developer. So if you did the test and you target value, you get credit. If you did the test and it was not in target, then you don't get credit. So it's kind of a way out of that independence problem, and it does speak to, you know, how many people were above and below the target given the test.
That's helpful. This is Lisa. Can I just ask a question? And the intended denominator for that combined measure, just so I understand your suggestion?
Well, to get into the whoever the at-risk population is for.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Would be, you know, the test plus, in addition, having an in-target value.
Great. Very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, were there any other questions or concerns on this measure?
Karen, this is Jeff. Just sort of a general comment. A lot of these sort of intermediate outcome measures are things that are called intermediate outcome measures. Look a lot like process measures. I guess they're called an intermediate outcome because they're using some kind of clinical lab value.
Yep.
But the clinical lab value is completely determined by the process. So essentially, it's a process measure, and which is basically why none of them risk adjust it. So I don't think what I said matters, but they treat them like they're process measures because the quote outcome is completely determined by the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is an argument that most use. In terms of our other criteria, those of you who maybe haven't sat on a NQF standing committee recently may not realize that while we do think maybe a little bit differently about intermediate clinical outcomes in terms of risk adjustment and whether or not, we definitely think about them the same way as process measures when it comes to So we are actually looking for, under the evidence criterion, which you guys don't have to worry about, we are asking for evidence that that lab value or what have you is important for the, you know, the health outcome of interest. And that's where we would talk a lot, I think, about the thresholds that are used in the measures.
But the threshold, just that the all of the data on the face validity, the expert panel, the references were all based on a level of 6, and yet the measure is 6.8. I don't know why they ignored that discrepancy. I don't know, you know, I don't know urate levels well enough to know that you could safely extrapolate and get the same degree of precision. That, you know, it just everything that they presented, you know, with articles and expert opinion was a level of 6, not 6.8. And then they made the measure 6.8.
Yeah, so when the standing committee, if they get this measure, they will be talking about that at length, I'm sure. And it does come up in validity a little bit, but it mostly comes up under the evidence criteria. Okay.
I thought it was because it was the face validity was all based on that.
Right, right. Okay, go ahead, if you haven't already, and cast your vote for validity for this measure. Again, you do not have to vote on reliability for this measure. Okay, we have almost a half hour left. So, Andrew, we're going to talk about hemodialysis. You feel like you can probably make a good effort on this one in 30
yep,
minutes?
I think so. And we've got a set of measures here related to mostly related to the adequacy of dialysis treatment, and I think the concerns that were raised by our panel members are very similar or virtually the same across all the measures. So hopefully we can kind of gain some efficiencies here. I suspect we'll still have to have our second call, but maybe it'll go quickly having had this first discussion. The first one we're talking about is measure number 249, delivered dose of hemodialysis above minimum. So this is the percentage of all patient months for patients on dialysis whose delivered dose of hemodialysis was SPKTV greater than or equal to 1.2. Similar to some of the ones we've talked about already, a lab value sort of classified as an intermediate outcome. We'll just sort of, you know, jump right into the concerns that were raised here. That I think the concerns largely related to the reliability testing. Reliability was tested at the score level, and the developers did assess what they called inter-unit reliability. Which they define as the proportion of the measure variability that is attributable to between facility variance. They used a bootstrap approach to estimate the within facility variation. And one of the things that our panel members raised is that they would like to see a little bit more detail on that bootstrap methodology. The testing did result in an inter-unit reliability score of 0.808 for this measure, which suggests roughly 81% of variation in the measure is attributed to between facility variation and around 20% attributed to within facility variation. One of the, again, main points of concern here is that, as noted by the developer, to their credit, this method for calculating inter-unit reliability was developed for measures that are approximately normally distributed across facilities, and that is in fact not the case for this measure. They say it is not normally distributed. And so they suggest that the value here, the inter-unit reliability score, should be interpreted with some caution. And our panel reviewers did, raise some concerns about that. So maybe we can just kind of start with some discussion about that. I think the sort of key questions here on reliability were the method appropriate, especially considering that it was the method was designed to assess measures that are normally distributed and these measures are not. And then, is the in light of that, are the results, interpretable? Do we have confidence that the measure can reliably distinguish between facilities? So any comments from our panel members?
Paul Kanansky, I had a more basic problem with the data element reliability.
Yeah, that was another issue that that was a concern raised, that there was not any data element reliability testing, and there is at least some reason to believe that it may not be.
One of their references, they said, I quoted it, no center apart from one unit managed to complete the collection of blood specimens as recommended by the guidelines. With one exception, blood collection for hemodialysis adequacy was not performed using proper technique in any center. So this would really suggest that the data elements used for the measure may not be reliable.
Yeah, so that's certainly something we can discuss. Was that a concern of any of our other reviewers?
This is Sherry. I don't have that specific concern, but I was also concerned about how many facilities got excluded on the basis of low volume. They didn't have patients. And for how many facilities did 11 patients constitute the entire population of patients? For larger facilities, did you include everybody? And if not, how were patients sampled? See, the issue of this, this volume issue is going to crop up again and again over the course of these measures. So if the sample size is all over the place by facility, then we got a volume outcome, a volume issue to deal with.
So maybe it would – oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I was one of the ones who talked about this bootstrapping and the issue about normal distribution. And they sort of, kind of been almost of all the three or four measures, they basically say that caution needs to be assumed or, but then just think about it. I mean, in practice, how exactly would that be – would that happen? So that, that needs some clarification. And I think in their case, it may not be an issue because I think they still have good number here in terms of sample size. But I guess all I needed was, if someone were to do it, how exactly, what exactly does it mean that when you say caution needs to be, used while interpreting the results? So that needs some clarification.
Great. Thank you. So yeah, so maybe this would be a good time to turn to our developers. Hopefully they are on the phone to address the questions of, for one thing, the reliability of data collection, and then the bootstrapping methodology, as well as this volume question, how many facilities were excluded on the basis of not having enough patients. So do we have a representative of the developer on?
Yeah, this is a subset of the developers at U of M Keck. A number of our team members did have to leave before this discussion started, so we will have to respond to some of these issues in writing after the meeting. But I'm going to hand it over to Doug Schauble to talk about one of the questions now.
Yeah, I can speak about the relationship between normality and reliability. And we did discuss that. Well, we didn't discuss that caveat. We mentioned that caveat, but it's not the case that we're going to overestimate reliability due to the non-normality. That's only going to hurt us. So in terms of contrasting within unit versus between unit variability, that's only going to cost us with respect to within unit variability. It's likely going to be overestimated.
Actually, this is Sherry. It's probably not. It's actually going to work in the other direction, because when you got tiny amounts of variability to deal with, small little perturbations don't matter as much. So one of the other things I would have liked to have seen is some statistical evidence of kurtosis or something that helps us understand the magnitude of the skew, number one. And secondly, did you think about doing like generalized estimating equations for generating the ICCs? Because those sometimes can help you compare. If you get the same results, and at least you're more confident that your data are meaningful. On the other hand, with this amount of positive skew, I also had some issues about how did you do the bootstrapping, how many samples, what the magnitude of the samples were that you took each time. So could you give us a little more clarification about how you approached what the magnitude of the skew was and how you approached the why'd you use ANOVA?
So I think we did, I don't know for sure exactly, but our sort of industry standard here is to do 100 bootstraps, which would definitely be sufficient for an exercise like this.
Of what how many patients per bootstrap? How many patients per procedure did you use?
So it would be, yeah, it would be replicating the data set, basically. So we want to replicate the stability of our procedure across the data set, so that would imply using a data set of the same size.
No, I know. You did 100 bootstrapping procedures of how many patients did you sample each time? You didn't use the entire population.
Yeah. 100,000?
Yeah, so we were generating data under the null using, like, what would represent the study population. Maybe I'm not understanding the question. I can think of a quicker way to do it would have been, like, what's called the M of N bootstrap, where you take fractions. You take fractions of each facility and bootstrap that way for computational savings, then you scale the results down in terms of variability, but that wasn't necessary for what we were doing.
Well, see, that's why we wanted to kind of understand exactly how you did it, because it's not clear from, at least I didn't read it, what I read in what was included, did you, within facility variability, so you wouldn't do a bootstrapping procedure on facilities that have 11 patients. But you could, you know, for a large sample of patients that say they have thousands of patients, you would do 100 bootstraps of 100 patients each just to see how much fluctuation in the results you get. So it isn't clear to me, and I don't think it's clear to some of the other folks who reviewed this measure exactly what you did.
There must be some difficulty with the way I'm describing it, actually, because we bootstrapped everything. There was no sampling involved. The resampling procedure is basically regenerating data under the null. Maybe there's a different use of the term bootstrap in this context, or generating data under the null that I'm not getting across, but that's not what we did. I also, if I can return to your comment about within versus between variability, I'm not following your logic about why we would be underestimating the within variability. That's not clear. But anyway, maybe we can move on.
Any comments from our reviewers on that? We're sorry, having a little discussion offline here amongst our staff. We're somewhat unfamiliar with that method of bootstrapping as well. Some folks around the table here have suggested that they only know of bootstrapping methods that involve sampling. I don't know if our panel members have any response to the developer's clarification.
So this is one more thing. This is with U of M CAC again. We can follow up to this with a better explanation of exactly what we did for bootstrapping, for clarity's sake, since it seems like there is some confusion about the terminology we've been using. So we will
follow
up with that after the meeting. Absolutely. Thank you.
Great.
And this is Karen from NQF. I think we'd have to ask you to get that to us by COB today, because we really need these votes from our methods panel panelists. So if you could do that by COB today, that'd be wonderful. We'll share it with them.
So I don't know that we can guarantee that. I do know that there is a follow-up meeting that is scheduled for next Friday, the 22nd. We could definitely get you all of the materials well ahead of that meeting so that the group can vote on it.
Great.
if that would be acceptable.
So we'll get back to you with a time, since apparently this kind of goes across all the measures. Okay. All right. So we may, I don't know if we can even ask our panelists to vote today, right?
Yeah. So what we can do is we'll look at the timeline and figure out the best date to give you, and we'll work with you to get that information out. I think we mentioned the next meeting is March 22nd, so we do have a little bit of time, but we want to be fair to our as a panel members so they make sure they have the right information. So probably not ask anyone to vote on the measures that we discussed today, and then we'll move from there. Does that sound fair to everyone?
That sounds fine. So you know, can I ask to the major developer one further question? Actually, Sherry brought up a very good point. So I understand that the bootstrapping is simply resampling, like you did resampling of the initial sample. I guess my question then would be, so I'm looking at here your sort of, you know, this document here. You had 6,407 facilities that had at least 11 patients. So I guess my first question would be, what was your unit of bootstrap? And, you know, did you bootstrap, like, you know, while doing the resampling, was your unit the facility or was it the patients?
I think we'll have to check in with some of the folks that are not here right now, so we will follow up with that response.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay.
Also, could I just ask for the developer to give us either Kolmogorov, Smirnov, or Kurtosis, or some statistic that looks like gives us some sense of the magnitude of the skew?
Yeah, we can do that. Thanks for the suggestion.
Okay. Well, that, I think, kind of, again, covers the remainder of the renal measures that we're going to discuss today. So I think we sort of have to postpone that discussion until we get a bit more information from the developer. We do have another call scheduled. Is it the 18th? Is that correct?
22nd.
Oh, sorry, 22nd. So I think we'll end up talking about these on that call. That gives the developer a little bit more time to get us some information about the bootstrapping method. So I think that we'll probably postpone discussion of all these measures. I don't think there were any concerns about validity on this measure, so we can just accept the ratings of the panel members unless anybody objects to that. All right. Well, I think anything else to cover on this call? Oh, there was one other measure that was some concern about validity. Again, I don't know if we want to wait until the second call because we have the same reliability issues to discuss. I guess since we have some time, maybe we can jump down and just address it very quickly. Measure 1423 and 2706 actually is the same kind of issue. Both of these measures actually had only face validity assessments. And I don't know that they, I think the face validity assessments that they did probably wouldn't be considered acceptable by NQF standards. They basically presented information on the development and approval of the measure by their clinical technical expert panel. And sort of, you know, suggested that implicitly demonstrates the face validity of the measure, but I don't believe they gave any of the, they did not do the sort of systematic assessment that we typically expect, which is a rating of, you know, whether the measure, you know, accurately reflects quality. And then give us some, you know, the voting results and some additional information like that. Do we have any discussion about that for measure 1423? This is, again, a dialysis adequacy measure related specifically to pediatric patients on hemodialysis.
And can you just, this is a maintenance measure, correct?
This is a maintenance measure, yes. So that's another issue that we typically expect empirical validity testing for, a maintenance measure. And if they only have face validity at that point, we expect some justification for that, which I don't believe we saw in this submission.
This is Sherry. Can I ask a question? Because with only, like, I was confused about whether it was 13 or 14, but that few eligible facilities, I mean, you can get some empirical data, but what's NQF's policy on, I mean, this is a very tiny number of facilities for which to draw some empirical evidence. It's pretty tough on the developer to, there is probably going to be a lot of within facility variation, so I don't know what we would garner out of getting more empirical testing.
Well, Andrew, this is Joe Masana from U of M Keck. May I introduce a comment I think that's directly relevant here?
Sure.
So I'm one of the nephrologists on the clinical team at Michigan, and I believe the two measures that you're discussing right now are pediatric measures. And when these measures were first presented a number of years ago, there was a hot debate at the CSAC, and I think even at the board of directors level, about the difficulties of pediatric, of developing and implementing pediatric measures in the ESRD community because of a very small population of pediatric patients. And there was specific discussion about those difficulties and whether or not pediatric measures should be considered in the same light because of the adverse numbers issues as adult measures. And it might be worthwhile to go back and to revisit some of that discussion about the pediatric measures. They were considered in a different context, I'll say, than the adult measures that were developed at the time.
I this is Paul. I could sense that sort of tension because the data suggests that potentially higher threshold might be more appropriate for the kids, but then when it comes to guidelines, people just decided to go with not lower than adults because I guess there just isn't enough data to be able to make a new threshold. Is that what happened?
That's a reasonable statement of my understanding of the work that was done back then, yes.
I mean, there hasn't been anything to change it, but so it's still sort of in face validity phase, but, that may be the best we can do. I don't know. Connected?
Yeah, sorry. Again, having some offline discussion here. So I think we'll probably, what was our decision here? Do we need to postpone to the next call on this one? I think we will. We sort of started in on the discussion here. So we can continue that on the next call. Was there anything that the developer might be able to clarify in the same way as they are with the reliability testing? Or maybe what we might ask of the developer on the NQF side is if you could give us some justification in writing for submitting this measure with only face validity testing for maintenance review. Is that something that we typically expect? That you give a rationale for why you were not able to do empirical validity testing at this stage. So it might be useful for us to have some, just a brief justification for why that you're submitting this with only face validity testing.
Yeah, this is the developer. We can do that.
Okay, great.
This is John Bott. Just two comments on this sort of topic. You know, as being on the panel, it seems like, you know, we're being told in the guidelines, in the guidance that, you know, after in maintenance, this measure must go beyond face validity. So right now, our hands are tied. We have to rate it as accordingly, and that would be, you know, it failing. Secondly, in regard to most of the instances we've seen in this round of these 10 measures, if the measure developer said we did face validity, they essentially provide virtually no explanation of what process was involved in that face validity. It just said they used the clinical panel and did face validity. That doesn't give us a lot to go on to give us any kind of confidence the integrity in which the measure was vetted through face validity. I'd like to see more stated about face validity other than just, you know, we use face validity testing. I think, you know, there's some acceptable face validity processes, and there'd be some processes that aren't acceptable. I think it needs to be fleshed out further.
So if there are any clarifications that the developer could give on the process for assessing face validity as well, that would be helpful. And with that, I think, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say we can, we'll provide that and include that in our write-up.
Okay, great. All right, well then, I think we can probably close out our call. Do we have any next steps or anything else we want to talk about with the panel?
So we'll send out more information about when we get the new information and what they can expect on the March 22nd call after the fact.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for your time. We appreciate it. We will talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.